This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Lewis Porter about his book published by Oxford University Press titled Reds in Blue, UNESCO World Governance and the Soviet Internationalist Imagination, which is really interesting, right? What did the Soviet Union think about UNESCO? How did they interact or not, as the case may be, with UNESCO? What does that help us understand about kind of these two massive political entities that we don't necessarily think about kind of in terms of each other? So, Lewis, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you so much, Miranda. It's awesome to be here.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Yeah, I get asked that a lot because UNESCO kind of seems like, you know, a bit of an obscure international organization. I mean, you know, their World Heritage Sites are everywhere. But I feel like it's kind of become one of many international organizations. So I often get asked why UNESCO. And it kind of dates back to graduate school and not really knowing what I was going to write my dissertation on. And desperately looking for a topic while taking graduate courses. So I was reading, I was in a course at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And, you know, that's where I went to graduate school. And I was in a course with Dr. Susan Pennybacker, who is a global historian. And she assigned a number of articles kind of on new histories of the United Nations, kind of getting away from diplomatic history and looking at the United Nations as a site of kind of global history. And what I noticed about these is that they were really interesting, but they were very Western-centric. And so I wanted to kind of introduce a Soviet dimension to these histories. And that's how I very much made my career. You know, that's sort of what I became interested in. I wrote my dissertation on it. Everything I've published has been sort of related to UNESCO and the United Nations. And UNESCO, I find, is kind of the most interesting of the United Nations agencies. So that's sort of how I got interested in it and why I decided to focus on it.
All right. Well, thank you for that backstory. Helps us bring us into the topic a little bit. I want to ask, I suppose, kind of conceptually, still on that point, kind of why UNESCO of it all? Because often we think of the Soviet Union as very much having kind of a political project and a certain idea of what the future should look like. And even if we maybe don't think of UNESCO as often, that is still something that kind of even in the popular imagination comes up. Even if it's just World Heritage Sites, there's still kind of a clear project there, a clear idea of what the future and the past could be. To what extent should we understand these two entities as having sort of projects and goals that run on parallel tracks that don't ever meet?
Yeah, so I think that so much of the literature, I think, on the Soviet Union at the United Nations focuses on the Soviet Union as kind of consisting of rigid ideologues, right? The diplomats tend to be against some of the more kind of utopian aspirations of the United Nations and UNESCO in particular. But what I kind of show is that they're actually more similar, right? They're running, you know, sort of on parallel tracks in that, you know, the Marxist-Leninist communist project is in many ways, you know, different and sort of a radical kind of vision of world order that is very much revolutionary, whereas the United Nations is not revolutionary, right? If it's anything, it's definitely not revolutionary. But at the same time, I think that they have kind of common overlaps. They're both sort of Enlightenment projects to remake world order. And particularly in the case of UNESCO, the goal is to use culture, including kind of an idea of heritage and kind of world heritage, as well as education and science to make a better world. And so that's how I kind of see the two projects sort of converging. Is that, at first they kind of seem like they're very parallel. They, you know, they're kind of antithetical to each other. The Soviet Union would constantly criticize various UNESCO projects that I'm sure we'll get into. But I think that really, you know, they have a lot of similarities. And that helps to explain, particularly after Stalin's death in 1953, why the Soviet Union would embrace UNESCO, despite all the criticisms that it had.
Well, before we get into the embrace, we do have to talk about what comes before it to understand it. So why wasn't the USSR involved with the early development of UNESCO? And how did this impact kind of the early years of the organization?
Yeah, that's a great question. So before Stalin's death in 1953, UNESCO was founded, I should say, in 45, 46. So, you know, like the UN, it was created after the Second World War. The Soviet Union was a principal architect of the United Nations. But Stalin was much more kind of a traditional great power diplomatic sort of thinker. He thought in great power relations. This was combined, as other historians have shown, with kind of a Marxist-Leninist revolutionary framework of understanding the world. But at the same time, you know, he was someone who very much thought that the United Nations should kind of be a policeman of the world, right? And that its role should be kept to a minimum when it came to things going beyond great power diplomacy. So, you know, things like the Security Council and the Soviet Union's veto on the Security Council were things that Stalin were okay with. He was much more skeptical of UNESCO and other so-called specialized agencies that sought to make the United Nations more of a world government, right? Something that could potentially intervene in the domestic affairs of countries and involve itself in sort of what the kind of domestic welfare state would involve itself in, right? So education, health, public health with the World Health Organization, labor, right, with the International Labor Organization, which actually pre-existed the creation of the United Nations, and the Soviet Union would boycott it too until after Stalin's death. So a lot of it was ideological. It was a rejection of the idea of a world government and kind of more maximalist forms of world governance. Stalin wanted to keep this to kind of a minimal degree. And so what I kind of argue is at the dawn of the Cold War, what this gave rise to was a dual power situation in world governance. And this is hearkening back for historians of the Soviet Union, be familiar with this idea of dual power, to the time between the February Revolution in 1917 and the October Revolution later that year, when there was kind of a dual power situation between the provisional government in Russia and the Soviet, right, which was much more radical. And so the Soviet Union, before Stalin's death, actually embarked on its own kind of version of world governance. That was led by a Soviet and was sort of intended to counter, I think, in many ways, a lot of the UN sort of projects and missions of that time period. Of course, the Soviet Union took part in some UN activities before Stalin's death, right? It was involved in various treaties and conventions, and was on the Security Council, up until 1950 and kind of the nadir of the Cold War during the Korean War, right? In the last final years of Stalin's death, right? So I think that what I kind of focus on is this ideological rejection of world governance in spheres beyond kind of traditional great power diplomacy. And in these years, UNESCO in particular was characterized as a cosmopolitan, right-wing socialist bid to kind of legitimize American global domination. It was seen as part of a cosmopolitan movement for world government by bourgeois idealists and pacifists who were the enemies of Soviet socialism. The anti-cosmopolitan campaign in the Soviet Union was primarily an attack on Soviet Jews and the intelligentsia. But what I show in my book is there was also this kind of attack on Western internationalism, and that the language of cosmopolitanism was very much also sort of couched in criticisms of the so-called one world movement in the West in the immediate post-war period. The idea that the UN could transcend traditional great power diplomacy and kind of create a world society of some sort.
All right. So that's a pretty critical view of, as you said, a lot of the aspects of the United Nations being developed, despite obviously some participation in them. So what changed, right? Why did the Soviet Union decide that UNESCO was going to be worth getting involved with? And what were their initial goals on becoming part of it?
Yeah, so I mean, the big thing that changed is Stalin died. So much in the Soviet Union.
Yep, that changes things.
What's that?
Yeah, that changes things.
Yes, exactly. That is the real sort of revolution, right? The post-Stalin period, right, is a period for non-kind of historians of the Soviet Union. It's a major watershed moment, right? The changes both in Soviet domestic society and in the Cold War don't happen overnight, right? So-called de-Stalinization is an uneven process that begins pretty quickly after Stalin's death, but takes a while, right? The famous secret speech in which Khrushchev denounced Stalin doesn't take place until 1956, so about 3 years after Stalin's death. But what I show is that actually with the UN, there's a pretty immediate about face, particularly on specialized agencies like UNESCO, the World Health Organization, the International Labor Organization, and the Interparliamentary Union, which is sort of an international organization of parliamentarians that was founded at the beginning of the 20th century, the late 19th and early 20th century. So there's this quick about face, right, by the new leadership, the collective leadership. It begins in October 1953. There is a resolution passed by the Presidium of the Communist Party, the leadership, to go ahead and join UNESCO and the International Labor Organization. And the main reasons of this is a fundamental rethinking of Soviet foreign policy internationally, both in relation to the West and a desire to cool the tensions of the Cold War. The Cold War really reaches its height during the Korean War in the last years of Stalin's life. And I think there's a genuine desire to lessen Cold War tensions, both for self-interested reasons. The Soviet leaders want to cool tensions because it is economically costly to fight this Cold War. But also, I think, a genuine desire for peace and a fear of war, right? The Soviet Union was a country that was ravaged by war and destroyed by war not too far in the past, right? Mm-hmm. Another reason is to kind of rally the international community towards socialism, right? The Soviet Union is an internationalist project. It became particularly nationalist and xenophobic in the last years of Stalin's rule. But there's a rejuvenation of internationalism that takes place in the Soviet Union in the 1950s. And a lot of the literature on this has focused on bilateral relations with Western countries, with the quickly decolonizing world of the global South. But what I show is there's also this kind of new thinking about the UN, right? And I kind of trace this and show how this developed. So yes, with the West and with kind of what we today might call the Global South, right, which was not called that back then, there is a need to reach out to countries in order to fulfill the kind of communist dream, right? And also challenge Western hegemony, right? So the West kind of dominates the UN for the first 8 years because of the Soviet absence. And there's an idea that the Soviet Union can sort of challenge the United States and the West from within the existing international system rather than just sort of being bystanders to it.
Does it work? I mean, how does this go? How does, for example, officials within the USSR react to actually trying to do this within UNESCO?
Yeah, it doesn't, they don't meet their own expectations, right? You know, the question of its works, obviously, you know, the Soviet Union does not sort of succeed in its kind of, you know, global mission to really overturn the Western world order in the long term. And I think there is a real desire to at least erode it more than what they are able to accomplish. And toward the end of the 1950s, there's actually a move to withdraw from UNESCO and other UN agencies. The Soviet leaders become so fed up with what's going on. They become very disillusioned, in particular with the United Nations bureaucracy, which is seen, and correctly so, I think, as dominated by Western personnel and bureaucrats, a so-called sort of Western deep state within the United Nations. And there's a move to withdraw. And a lot of this has to do also with specific kind of complaints about the UN. So the fact that Taiwan is still representing China, right? There's a, you know, the endless complaint about that. It's a very public complaint that the Soviet Union had with the UN and all of its specialized agencies. So it doesn't really work. But what I show is that by the 1960s, the Soviet Union views UNESCO as kind of its best bet to continue challenging the West. And this is as a result of decolonization, which we can talk about later.
In fact, I'd like to talk about that now because we've raised it. So why is UNESCO the best bet, and what does decolonization have to do with it?
So decolonization changes the face of the United Nations. It changes the face of the General Assembly, which is kind of the parliament of the United Nations, thinking about it again as kind of a world government. And it changes the General Conference of UNESCO, which is UNESCO's equivalent of the General Assembly, sort of the popular House of Representatives for American readers of the United Nations. And the Soviet Union sees this as a real opportunity to sort of decolonize the United Nations, right? To challenge Western hegemony over the United Nations. It is sort of astounding the influence that the West had within the United Nations before this and how dominated it was by Western bureaucrats, but also sort of unofficial Western influence. I talk about in my book the kind of McCarthyist campaign in the UN to rid communists, or to rid the UN of communists. And there's a real kind of Western dominance of this organization that I think is forgotten about today, precisely because decolonization changes the face of the United Nations. In the 1960s, this takes the form of an interest in technical assistance and aid being delivered to the weakly developed countries, as the Soviet Union would call these countries. And so the Soviet Union becomes very attached to UNESCO as kind of its best bet of reaching out to these weakly developed countries, but also kind of eroding Western influence. And a lot of this is because the Soviet Union was able to get UNESCO to hire a lot of Soviet secretariat workers, particularly in important areas to the Soviet Union, like science. So the science department within UNESCO that oversees scientific technical aid to weakly developed countries is actually headed by a Soviet scientist. And he very much makes sure that the Soviet Union is kind of given a chance to use UNESCO to develop relations with weakly developed countries. And the fact is that the Soviet Union had an extremely weak kind of position in a lot of the other specialized agencies. So they themselves say, you know, UNESCO is the place where we have the strongest position compared to places like the International Labor Organization, the World Health Organization, the Food and Agriculture Organization, which the Soviet Union is not even an official member of until essentially the end of the Soviet Union.
So what was it like for these Soviet officials who were involved in these positions in UNESCO? Were there, I mean, you've mentioned kind of what sorts of positions and areas they were in. Was it a lot of them? Did the Soviet Union want more? Were they suspicious of it? I mean, how involved were they?
That's a great question. This was a small number of people, right? This is a small group of kind of white collar professionals. You might call them the kind of intelligentsia of the Soviet Union. Although in Russian history, that often implies kind of a criticism of the state. These were, you know, loyal Soviet citizens, right? White collar professionals. UNESCO is interesting because the people who worked in its bureaucracy were not just diplomats, and they tended to come from a more diverse variety of white collar professions. And this is simply because UNESCO is an organization dedicated to very broad things like education, science, and culture. So the head of the UNESCO library was a Soviet librarian from the Lenin State Library in Moscow. There were teachers, Soviet teachers, who worked in the UNESCO Secretariat and the Department of Education, overseeing things like international understanding programs, so sending materials that kind of cultivated international understanding to public schools internationally, and these kind of things. So it was much more diverse, and that's one reason I find it kind of interesting. UNESCO in particular, kind of the experience of the Soviet citizens who were not used to living abroad, were ideologically prepared and deemed ideologically prepared to live abroad, but were not sort of diplomats who were used to kind of playing the game of international relations. There was a lot of suspicion of them. There was a lot of criticism of them. UNESCO's headquarters is in Paris. I talk about in the book kind of the daily life of Soviet secretariat workers who had to go find apartments in Paris while their country was invading Hungary in 1956. And, you know, often they would be, you know, people would slam the door on them, like landlords would not rent to them. Because they were seen as, you know, spies, right? One secretariat worker I talk about, Zhegalova, who worked in the UNESCO Department of Education and was a teacher, she actually became kind of a target of American anti-communist propaganda because she oversaw a lot of the secondary school stuff within UNESCO. And so in the United States in the 1950s, UNESCO was considered a kind of front for communist propaganda. And organizations like the John Birch Society and others really saw UNESCO as a front for Soviet domination, which is absurd given the fact that the Soviet Union struggled to erode Western power over it. But that is how kind of the American right saw them. And so there was actually this movement by American parents to kind of get rid of UNESCO materials from public schools in the United States. And Zhegalova was kind of the evil kind of mastermind of this international understanding materials from the perspective of the American right. You know, there's this notion that this person from Moscow is overseeing, you know, UNESCO propaganda materials, right? So it was very hard for them. They faced a lot of suspicion and they had to kind of navigate their dual roles, both as servants of the Soviet state and international civil servants who were bound by contract to only serve the United Nations and to not act on the interests of their home country.
That's not easy, right? Particularly given kind of the emphasis that the Soviet Union is putting on these officials. And as you mentioned earlier, they're kind of deemed to be able to go abroad. Can you maybe speak a bit more about how these officials kind of on a daily basis figured out how to balance between these competing needs?
Yeah, definitely. That's sort of the focus of one of the chapters in my book is how they kind of negotiate these kind of dual loyalties between the United Nations and the Soviet Union. The Soviet embassy in Paris wanted to control these secretariat workers. They told them to break the rules of the International Civil Service and to essentially act as spies within the international organization. But what I show is that actually a lot of these Soviet citizens wanted to serve the international organization as well. And they sought to kind of do both. And how they did this was they identified certain areas in which the UNESCO project to make a better world and the Soviet project to make a better world overlapped. And so this is why what I mentioned earlier, this idea of kind of converging internationalisms is important to kind of understanding how Soviet citizens experienced this task. The idea of making a better world through education, through science and culture is something that both the Soviet Union and UNESCO shared. And so things like delivering educational technical assistance to the developing world is something that Soviet citizens could excel at in their job while also serving the interests of the Soviet state. Another example I give is with Zhegalova again, working on women's rights, which the United Nations is supporting at this time. And the Soviet Union is also at least propagandistically supporting, right? Both in their own ways are kind of, you know, patriarchal institutions. They don't live up to kind of their rhetoric about women's rights. But at the same time, they both kind of advertise themselves as wanting to give women education, getting rid of discrimination in education, which UNESCO works on in the 1950s, and things like that. So someone like Zhegalova became kind of the unofficial point person for women's issues within UNESCO. And so she was able to kind of both serve Soviet interests to show the Soviet progress, or at least the claimed progress, on women's issues and teaching and education, while at the same time supporting UNESCO in that role. At the same time, a lot of Soviet citizens struggled with these dual roles. So I do talk about Soviet secretariat workers who defected to the West, Soviet secretariat workers who were sent home for violating the very rigid rules sort of governing their lives from the Soviet embassy abroad. They weren't allowed to kind of partake in Western culture, even though they did, and things like this, right? So it was a tough position, but my overarching argument is that a lot of them were able to sort of excel in their positions.
No, which is very interesting, given kind of the circumstances that they're trying to navigate. Yeah. I'd like to ask about a different section of the book, the idea of UNESCO's publications being in some ways kind of a big part of what they're doing, and especially being particularly enticing for the Soviet Union. Why?
That's a great question. Yeah, so this is the last chapter in my book. That focuses on UNESCO publications as a way of understanding the importance of United Nations publications. I think since kind of the advent of the internet, it's forgotten how important UN publications were to spreading international knowledge. I remember in kind of the first floor of the library at my undergraduate institution, my graduate institution, there were often these old books of both UN treaties and UN documents, but also kind of UN encyclopedias and things like this. And so the UN was actually a major kind of international publisher during the Cold War and before, you know, information sort of was able to proliferate internationally through things like the internet. And so the Soviet Union saw UN publications as a way of getting its message out. Of spreading kind of communist propaganda or at least positive impressions of the Soviet Union under the seal of approval of a neutral international organization. So the first part of the chapter that focuses on UN publications kind of talks about this and how Soviet officials very much viewed these publications as a way to kind of sort of launder their propaganda, right? You know, instead of bilateral kind of propaganda, which everyone knew was being published by, you know, the Soviet Union in Moscow, by Progress Publishers or whatever, these were, you know, coming published under the UN seal of neutrality, right? This was the international organization saying, that Soviet statistics about how great its educational system was were legit, right? These were the real thing, even though a lot of them were famously sort of exaggerated and painted a overly rosy picture of Soviet statistics. So they were very much interested in kind of that aspect of it, getting their message out internationally and also to many different countries at the same time, right? So UN publications would be translated into the world's major languages, and they would end up in Africa, in Asia, in the United States, and in Western Europe. And they wouldn't be subject to censorship in the same way that other publications were. There's a famous story that is hard to establish the extent of its validity because it's kind of through hearsay, but I think it gives a sense of how the UN viewed these publications. Nelson Mandela reportedly would read UNESCO publications while he was imprisoned because they were seen as kind of neutral information. So he wasn't allowed to get other things that might seem to challenge the South African apartheid regime, but was allowed to read UN publications because they were considered kind of non-political, right? And this is a story that's told on UNESCO's website. And I think, you know, it kind of speaks to the self-image of UNESCO is kind of breaking down barriers, right, as being a purveyor of international information.
Did that extend to breaking barriers within the Soviet Union? Did everyday people read these publications?
Yes, absolutely. And I was actually really surprised the extent to which these publications were actually very important for Soviet citizens after Stalin's death, of course, who were very hungry for any information about the outside world. Beginning in about 56, 57, the Soviet Union starts to also import UNESCO publications. And they become very, very important to Soviet citizens, academics who want information about the outside world, including statistics about other countries, scientific publications. So UNESCO has several scientific journals that at the time are seen as kind of leading journals, leading scientific journals internationally. And so a lot of this is sort of devoured by Soviet citizens. And it's not just sort of narrow kind of statistics and academic journals, but also UNESCO would publish a popular magazine called the UNESCO Courier that was essentially like an internationalist or UN version of Life magazine, the American Life magazine. It would have kind of general interest stories from around the world that tended to kind of support the UN project and kind of an internationalist ethos. And what I show in my book is a lot of Soviet citizens loved this magazine. It was seen as just, you know, this really important means of communication with the outside world. And they would write letters to the editor, letters to the editor of the Courier. And then the Courier would publish those letters, kind of creating an international reading public for Soviet citizens who wanted to connect with people from the outside world.
I definitely found that section of the book quite interesting because that isn't necessarily what I expected reading it. Was there anything either in that chapter or really any of the research you did for this book that you found particularly surprising?
A lot of it. I had no idea how this project was going to go when I first got into it. There was very kind of little information about Soviet participation in UNESCO published. A lot of it dated back to kind of the Cold War and was filled with kind of American presumptions about the USSR kind of cynically using these international organizations. And so when I went to Moscow to do archival research, I had no idea what I was going to get. And so finding these letters, I think, was probably one of the most surprising things. Just the sheer kind of interest of Soviet citizens in the United Nations and in working for peace. A lot of them would write and kind of concoct these ideas about how the United Nations could work for peace internationally in the midst of the Cold War, right? So, you know, passing UN conventions on different things, including like the environment, but also kind of operating as a place where knowledge can be exchanged for the purpose of peace. And so that was truly surprising. Also kind of the geographical distribution of these letters. So I kind of expected a lot of kind of these publications to be, you know, only in Moscow or Leningrad, kind of the major European capitals of the Soviet Union. But there are really letters from throughout the Soviet Union, which kind of was evidence to me that, you know, while not widely circulated in the sense of like Soviet materials, it was widely circulated for a foreign magazine, and kind of really unique in that regard. The other thing I found interesting, going back to kind of the Secretariat chapter, was the criticisms Soviet Secretariat workers had of their own country. They would write kind of annual reports in the same way a lot of employees do, kind of summing up their work for their Soviet sort of overseers. And a lot of them would criticize the Soviet state and its inability to kind of embrace UNESCO and kind of use it to the full extent and fully participate in it. In fact, it was Soviet citizens in the Secretariat who were partially responsible for the Soviet Union staying in the late 1950s when there was a question of whether or not they might withdraw. So they launched kind of a letter writing campaign, kind of urging the Soviet state to keep in UNESCO and to stay in it. And it's hard to see how much that had an influence, but they stayed in it and they were part of kind of this campaign to keep them in there. So, you know, kind of the conclusion of the book is that there was a Soviet group of one worlders, that Soviet citizens, especially among the intelligentsia, you know, in a small group again, but a powerful group, an influential group, saw the UN as a means of working for a better world, and supported the UN as kind of part of a Soviet internationalist ethos.
Very interesting. Thank you for sharing those with us. And leaving me really with only my final question. You mentioned at the beginning that this book kind of has been a consistent interest for you, this idea of the Soviet Union and the United Nations, the Soviet Union internationally, that you've done sort of a number of pieces in this sort of vein. Is that what you might be working on next? Is there anything you'd like to highlight about your current or upcoming work?
Yeah. You know, I kind of wish I could continue working on this to some degree, and I probably will. One of the things, you know, that I think every historian of the Soviet Union is dealing with is the lack of access to archives, right? Particularly central archives, which are important for Soviet foreign policy in light of the current war, right? So I am sort of thinking about how I can continue to work on the UN as kind of a side project. But my next major project is going to be focused on sort of a biography of a foreign minister who was instrumental in Soviet foreign policy during the Cold War, Andrei Gromyka. And he was also Soviet ambassador to the United Nations in the early part of his career. So I kind of see it as kind of related on this next project, the biography. But it's also kind of going in a different sort of direction.
All right. Well, that's intriguing. So thank you for the sneak preview. And of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, titled Reds in Blue, UNESCO, World Governance, and the Soviet Internationalist Imagination, published by Oxford University Press. Lewis, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.